My name is Len Rubenstein. I'm director of an organization called Physicians for Human Rights, which is based in Boston and Washington. And for the last 20 years, our organization has, among other work, has worked to try to prevent torture around the world. We do clinical evaluations of victims of torture. We do training, and we do advocacy to try to stop torture. And if you had asked me in the year 2000, or even in the summer of 2001, whether Physicians for Human Rights would ever have to devote a lot of energy, resources.
It's not loud enough. Can you make it a little louder before you start?
Okay. Okay, sorry about that. If you had ever asked me whether we would be spending time fighting torture by the United States, not only fighting it after the Abu Ghraib scandal broke, but for years since, I would have said that can't happen here. But that turned out to be naive. And that I'd like to tell you the story of what's happened in this country, why it came about, and how the confusion about being tough and being tough-minded led to catastrophe, not only for the people who are subjected to torture, but for our values and for people around the world who look to the United States for leadership in the fight against torture. I want to start in this work. I've met many people in the military and intelligence community, including a guy named Mike Gellis, who is a criminal investigator for the Naval Intelligence Service. And I was having coffee with him one day, and he said, you know, that famous ticking bomb scenario, if I had someone who we thought knew where a nuclear weapon or some other bomb was going to go off, and it was my job to stop him, I would sit down and have a cup of tea with him, and I'd figure out how to stop this. And in fact, over the years, there has been an enormous amount of work done in interrogation in which techniques of interrogation, all of which involve sitting down and talking to people, sometimes in an incredibly manipulative way, have been very successful. It actually started or took off after the 1993 World Trade Center bombing. And we were learning more and more about Al-Qaeda. And in those days, in the 90s, there wasn't torture of suspects. There was a lot of interrogation. But somehow, we went off track. And I'd like to talk about that story. The baseline, let me start with the baseline, which I just alluded to, that there was no belief that torture worked for gaining information. And it was actually the view of the military. There was a manual put out in the 80s and 90s, revised, called an Army Field Manual about how to interrogate people. And I'd just like to quote from it. It said, experience indicates the use of force is not necessary to gain the cooperation of sources of interrogation for interrogation. Therefore, the use of force is a poor technique as it yields unreliable results, may damage subsequent collection efforts, and can induce the source to say whatever he thinks the interrogator wants to hear. And that's why the manual went on that the use of force, mental torture, threats, insults, exposure to unpleasant or inhumane treatment of any kind is prohibited by law, as it was, and is neither authorized nor condoned by the U.S. government. And with respect to the law, we actually had made enormous headway in the fight against torture around the world. Not only did the Universal Declaration of Human Rights after the Second World War say there may never be any torture or cruel treatment under any circumstances, but a separate convention, an international treaty, was signed and ratified, including by the United States. And the U.S., the Congress, enacted a criminal statute against torture committed outside the United States. So we had a track record. So how did torture become a common practice? Well, we know torture goes back thousands of years. If you go back to the Greeks, you can find justifications of torture and why they thought it was necessary. But by the time of the Enlightenment, torture had become delegitimized. And it wasn't, and as I mentioned, by 1948, it had been universally condemned. and outlawed. But at the same time, something else was going on. During the Cold War, with the experience of prisoners in captivity by the Chinese communists and the Korean War, and stories of brainwashing, the CIA got very interested in what these techniques were and how not only did they brainwash people, but they were figuring out psychological methods or purporting to develop psychological methods to get information from people. And those methods included things like isolation for long periods of time, sleep deprivation, humiliation, depriving people of their dignity by removing their clothing. Sound familiar? These were the techniques that started to be discussed and studied and kind of incorporated even in manuals that the CIA started writing in the 50s and 60s. Of course, that was all discredited by the 1970s when there were congressional investigations of CIA techniques, and the use of these methods or the interest in these methods pretty much died. But the theory kind of hung around, and the theory was that you can induce a state of regression, that you can make people talk, you can get information from people. The problem was there was no evidence whatsoever. In fact, the Defense Intelligence Board recently issued a report saying, well, what's the empirical evidence that this works? Well, the empirical evidence is that it doesn't work. Not only doesn't it yield information, but it tends to create great harm and create psychological reactions, including dissociation, even psychosis in certain cases, that leads to false positives, that people start confessing the things they didn't do. We know this actually from the Soviet Union. Those of you who have read Darkness at Noon or have read about how under Stalin's rule, people who were purged confessed to all kinds of counter-revolutionary acts that they didn't commit. So we had this interest in the 50s and the Cold War. We had reviews of these techniques. And all everybody knew was that these were incredibly harmful. They were very destructive to people's personalities. They led to nightmares. They led to post-traumatic stress disorder. And they were completely discredited. Well, that was then. Then along came 9/11. And right away, something happened after 9/11, as you all know. We got scared. And at the highest levels of government, really in the White House, the Vice President, the White House Counsel, others not from the military and not even from the intelligence community were deeply, deeply interested, as you can imagine, in what they called actionable intelligence. Actionable intelligence means not information used for criminal prosecution, as most criminal justice interrogations are for, but action, information that could help stop a future attack. There was obviously, and still is, concern about future attacks. So there was a drive for actionable intelligence. And there was a second factor, that we were not going to be, we weren't going to take this lying down. We were going to be tough. We were going to take the gloves off. In fact, in 2003, Covert Black, who was an intelligence official in the government, actually testified in Congress that there was before 9/11 and there was after 9/11. And now, after 9/11, we're going to take the gloves off. Well, what were they going to do? Now, this was, to me, a psychological stance, a political stance, not a stance based on either knowledge or values, that our tough guy posture, our unwillingness to allow the terrorists to intimidate us, that is what was driving decision making. So it was very early on, I'm sure you all remember, in early 2002, the first thing that happened after we captured many captured many people in Afghanistan, Taliban and Al-Qaeda and many, many others who had nothing to do with either. They were all captured in Afghanistan, and many of them were sent to Guantanamo. And the first thing that happened is the White House Counsel determines or decides the Geneva Conventions don't apply to those people and makes a statement that we cannot be bound by the restrictions on interrogation contained in the Geneva Conventions. And remember, you all remember from the movies, the World War II movies, about what the Geneva Conventions require is only name, rank, and serial number if you're a prisoner of war. Well, you can do more than that, but there are certainly restrictions, and you can certainly not engage in any form of torture, humiliation, infringement on human dignity. So that started it. And what were they going to do? What were they going to do? Well, they could look to the past. They could look to the techniques that the CIA had been using and developing back in the 50s and 60s, and they looked somewhere else as well. The more they weren't getting actionable intelligence, as they saw it, in the spring of 2002, and they weren't. There were all kinds of memos in April, May, June, after people had been in custody at Guantanamo for 3 months. They weren't getting what they needed. So let's look somewhere else. Well, here's a somewhere else they looked. Since the 50s, since the Korean War, the Army has run a program to train American soldiers to resist abuse. It's called Survival, Evasion, Resistance, and Escape. It's otherwise known as SEER after the initials. And this program basically is to train people to deal with a situation where they are captured by an enemy that does not abide by the Geneva Conventions. What's going to happen? So as our Army does quite well, it trains. So they trained people by abusing them. And this tens of thousands of soldiers have gone through this program. In fact, it's such an interesting program that people interested in studying post-traumatic stress disorder use this as kind of a natural experiment. You could never do experiments in post-traumatic stress because it would be unethical to impose stresses on people that would lead to that. But because of the severity of this training program, scholars and scientists have actually studied what happened to people and who gets it and who doesn't. There's a fellow at Yale who has published. You can look it up in the scientific literature. Now, this program, of course, was designed to resist. They put people in stress positions. They put people in isolation. They played loud music. They did all the kinds of things, insult, screaming, all the kinds of abuses that they could think of, short of physical harm, that might be inflicted on a captured soldier. Well, in the spring of 2002, when this intelligence wasn't coming through, the psychologists involved in this SEER program got together with psychologists at Guantanamo, psychologists in the Special Operations Division, and the leaders of these programs, and said, let's reshape this program for offensive purposes. Let's use the SEER techniques as interrogation methods. Now, no one thought SEER was not meant to gain information. It was made to train people to resist. So that was the theory. So we're going to use these techniques. And by the way, where did I get this information? Am I making this up? The Office of the Inspector General of the Defense Department actually has a report, and I can give you the citation of this report, that explains how this came about. But they had another problem. We're in the spring of 2002 now. They had another problem. The problem was, this is illegal. I mentioned earlier we have a criminal statute against torture. And this statute actually is very powerful because, among other things, it criminalizes psychological torture. And although it's got a very complicated definition, it boils down to the notion that you can't do things to people that would severely disrupt their senses and personality, and by doing so cause harm, which of course is exactly what these techniques are designed to do, isolation, sleep deprivation, and the like. So what did they do? They had to reinterpret the law. So the Justice Department came through, and you all know, I'm sure, this was infamous, reported all over the place, that they redefined torture, redefined pain for physical injury, that it had to be at the level of pain as organ failure, impairment of bodily function, or even death. And for psychological pain, it's even better. It had to be drug-induced dementia, onset of psychiatric disorder, including hallucinations or delusions, the onset of obsessive compulsive disorder, or pushing individuals to the brink of suicide. Short of that, it didn't count as pain, therefore it didn't count as torture, therefore it was legal. So by the summer of 2002, we have the theory, the SEER theory, and the old CIA techniques, and we have the legal basis to move forward. And this starts happening at Guantanamo. And by the fall of 2002, people like Mike Gellis, who I mentioned at the beginning, go down and see what's going on. These are professionals. And the FBI went down there, and they were appalled. FBI reported in one case, he observed the detainee after been subjected to intense isolation for 3 months. During the period, he said, the detainee was totally isolated in a cell that was always flooded by light. Sensory deprivation and sensory overload were both used. By late November, this is 2002, the detainee was evidencing behavior consistent with extreme psychological trauma, talking to non-existent people, reporting hearing voices, crouching in the corner of the cell, and covered with a sheet for hours on end. Well, that led to some controversy within the Defense Department, and it went all the way up to the Secretary of Defense, coming to a head in December, because there was a man at Guantanamo, still there, named Mohammed al-Qahtani, who was alleged to be one of the 9/11 hijackers who got caught. He got caught before 9/11, but he was obviously a key suspect, a key detainee, had a lot of information. And he wasn't yielding any information. And of course, people like him were tough. They were resistant. So the interrogation plan, incorporating the techniques I've described, went up for legal review and went to the Secretary of Defense, and he approved. And what happened to al-Qahtani? Well, he was interrogated for about 54 consecutive days. During that time, he was kept in isolation, never allowed to sleep more than 4 hours. He was, every conceivable technique to humiliate him was used, pouring water over his head, forced to wear women's underwear, forced to parade around on a dog leash, being told that they told other detainees that he was gay, which for a Muslim was shocking and humiliating and scary, and multiple of these techniques at the same time. He actually at one point rebelled by stopping drinking water. Doctors got involved. There was a doctor involved giving him IV, intravenous fluids. At the same time, they were playing loud music to prevent him from sleeping. So what's happening in this whole process is, first, we're corrupting our values by using techniques we know are damaging and don't work. Two, we are corrupting the law by taking a statute and turning it inside out. And now we're corrupting other professions, including the medical profession and the psychologists who are also involved. This interrogation, by the way, was leaked to Time magazine. It's the only interrogation log that was ever leaked. And after it was leaked, the Defense Department decided to have a legal review of an investigation of this interrogation. And they concluded, interestingly, that while some of the techniques were not very nice, they were all authorized at the time. Oh, including the use of dogs. I forgot the use of dogs. You know about the dogs. But they were degrading, but didn't reach the level of being inhumane and therefore were legal. So as we go into 2003, there's beginning to be some protest. There are some heroes within the military, the JAG Corps, the lawyers in the military, the general counsel of the Navy, others started to protest. So they have a review. But by the end of the review, in April 2003, we already have established these techniques at Guantanamo. We have special teams called behavioral science consultation teams, which are psychologists involved in evaluating detainees, sharing medical information about their phobias and their weaknesses with interrogators, and we have routinized torture at Guantanamo, and it can't be stopped even after there are some restrictions applied in a further review of 2003. Well, what happens in 2003 besides that? We start the war in Iraq in March. We start having prisoners come into U.S. custody at Abu Ghraib and other places in Iraq. And these techniques, as one investigator put it, migrate to Iraq. In fact, they sent General Miller, who ran the base at Guantanamo, to Iraq to train the units in Iraq. Did I say he was at Guantanamo? They sent him to Iraq to bring those techniques, migrate them to Iraq. Same time, some of the SEER trainers from Fort Bragg, which the SEER program is based, go to Iraq as well. So by the time we get to Abu Ghraib, what we have is kind of routinized use of torture. And let me give you some examples of what I mean by routinized. In Guantanamo, one of the reports mentions a frequent flyer program. That's what they called it. It was a frequent flyer program used to make sure that people didn't sleep. So they moved them all the time. Every 4 hours, they would move people from cell to cell to prevent and disrupt their sleep. There are reports showing that the nakedness you saw at Abu Ghraib was routine, that the use of isolation at Abu Ghraib was routine. And then what always happens in torture, when it goes back to that ticking bomb, when people talk about instances of torture, you have intelligence you need and you need it today. What always happens, regardless of the legitimacy of that, and I think I can explain why that's not a good way of looking at it, it tends to establish a regime of torture. That once you go down the road, all the restraints leave, and the logic of getting information requires you to torture everybody because you don't know what you don't know. So not only Mr. A may have information, but you don't know if Mr. B also has information. Or Mr. C may have a brother-in-law who has information, so you have to torture Mr. C and the brother-in-law. And that's what happens. It breaks down the values of the people in the facility, and then terrible damage starts to happen. By 2003 or 2004, the Pentagon reported 350 incidents of self-harm at Guantanamo. This is before the suicides and the hunger strikes. 350 incidents of self-harm. There were only 900 people there, and they reported 300 incidents of self-harm. They actually sent some forensic psychiatrists to Guantanamo to see what they could do to stop the self-harm. They could have done something else than send psychiatrists to stop the harm. The Red Cross, which goes and had access to Guantanamo, wrote reports which were subsequently leaked to the media, not by the Red Cross, but by others, expressing alarm at the mental deterioration of detainees. And so that began the fight to get interrogation under control and get the conditions that under which people were held that went beyond interrogation, that is, the use of routine conditions of confinement, isolation, moving people outside the interrogation context, which were used to soften people up, and you heard about this at Abu Ghraib. So what Abu Ghraib showed us actually showed us one thing. Abu Ghraib showed us that someone took pictures. It didn't show us that this was one place where abuse was happening. It showed us that there were pictures. There were no pictures at Guantanamo. There were no pictures at Bagram Air Force Base in Afghanistan. But what we did have is routinized use of torture, the breakdown of values. So what do we do? What do we do about this? It's very hard to restore values, and we've seen very difficult public relations problems. We have the Program 24, which glorifies torture. And we have public opinion surveys, which shows the majority of people in this country have been and remain against the use of torture. But when you say, well, should torture be used in special cases where we absolutely need the information? Well, maybe. Because they don't understand, A, that it doesn't work, B, that it spreads like a virus, and C, that you can't control it. The real problem was leadership at the top. Many of you have heard the president say many times, we do not torture. The United States condemns torture. The United States does not engage in torture. Well, it's easy to say that when you've defined torture in such a way that what he really is saying is nothing we do counts as torture. That's what he's really saying. Nothing we do counts as torture. In fact, something quite extraordinary has happened. The same day last fall, when the forces within the Pentagon, which were opposed to these techniques, finally prevailed. They prevailed because there was leadership from Senator McCain. There was leadership from people within the military. There was a Supreme Court decision last spring, that spring of 2006, saying that the Geneva Conventions did apply. And so in the fall of 2006, the Defense Department actually issued a new manual on interrogation. And they said, we're coming clean. We are now abolishing these techniques, abolishing waterboarding. I hadn't mentioned that before, which is mock drowning. Abandoning the use of dogs, abandoning the use of sleep deprivation. No, they didn't do that. I'll get to that in a minute. Abandoning most of the horrific techniques. And they said, we are a professional military organization. We believe in the Uniform Code of Military Justice. We have strong values about human dignity, so we are not going to do this anymore. They did leave a few techniques in. They left isolation and sleep deprivation, so that fight will continue. But they basically abandoned those techniques. That was the morning. That was in the morning, one day last October. In the afternoon, the president gave a speech. Same day, the Defense Department says, we are not doing this anymore. He said, we are transferring these 14 high-value detainees that we're keeping in secret prisons that we've kidnapped, called Extraordinary Rendition, and we're sending them to Guantanamo for trial, and they were sent. And we continue to believe in the enhanced interrogation techniques. Enhanced interrogation techniques is a euphemism, of course, and it's a euphemism for all the kinds of things that I just talked about. So the very same day, we have one branch of government saying, never again. We have the president saying, I embrace this. And that's pretty much where we stand today. There was a law passed in the fall, the Military Commissions Act, which adopted very convoluted definitions of what war crimes are. And so there is a fight going on about whether those definitions prohibit the techniques that the CIA has used as well as the Defense Department. And that is now, as we speak, subject to a fight within the administration. And the reason they haven't come to a decision is that the vice president is pushing very hard for the continuation of all these draconian, harsh, damaging forms of torture. And others are saying it's time to stop. Well, I want to open this up now for discussion. It's supposed to be a discussion. I wanted to just spend a few minutes giving this background. But just to conclude, I mentioned before that we've had corrosion in values, corrosion in the rule of law. I can talk more about the corrosion of the professional role, both in psychology and medicine. But we've had something else happen. We've had American leadership in human rights just plummet. Guantanamo, secret prisons, kidnapping, torture have really taken U.S. leadership in human rights from up here. In Europe, people looked to the United States for leadership on human rights to down here. In Germany, from 60% believing the United States was a leader in human rights to 16%. But it goes beyond that. What's really happened is that people around the world who are being tortured in Syria and in Egypt, in Uzbekistan, and all kinds of places in the world, really once looked to the United States as a source of hope. U.S. ambassadors advocated to stop unlawful detention, to stop torture. And these, imagine if you're the U.S. ambassador in one of these countries, and you go to the government and say, you must stop doing this. Imagine what they're going to say back and what they're going to throw in your face, and imagine the impact you're going to have. That's what's happened. So the fight isn't over. We must restore these values. We've had indications that it can happen. It's happening within the Defense Department, which is a very good sign. But it's not over. And that's actually why I'm talking to you this morning, because I deeply believe that not only does it have to stop to restore human dignity and to restore values, but that we'll actually be safer. We're safer because torturing people creates a kind of environment where contempt for the United States actually is increasing, where recruitment of new terrorists is made easier, and where we're not getting any information that's helping us. In fact, my last comment is one of the most extraordinary aspects of this is that the administration, in only one instance, claimed that it got good information from its interrogation techniques. Only one instance. And in that instance, their claim is shown to be completely wrong. So we're not even getting the information we want. So I'll stop here. We've got a lot of smart people in the room, so let's go. I saw your hand first. Before you talk, I'm going to have to repeat questions for the tape. Yes, there's a lot of evidence. There's evidence that many of them experience the same kind of post-traumatic stress symptoms that others subjected to horrific conditions of war experience. And there are actually some interrogators who have come forward and written about what they experienced, what they did, and what the impact was on them. I actually just violated what I said. The question was about what's the effect on interrogators. Yes?
Yeah, just a comment. Your lecture should be given to a country such as Iran, who just recently detained four Americans in Iran. I have been very close to Tal Espandieri, who's been in solitary now for 6 weeks, 67-year-old grandmother. And I guess I really don't have a question other than the fact that it should be an international body or somebody to regulate torture around the world. But you're dealing with other entities who really don't respect what you're suggesting.
The question or the comment was about how Iran is engaging in torture, which is true. There are probably 70 countries, according to Amnesty International, that engage in torture. And it's absolutely true that these countries need to be condemned, pressure needs to be put on them to stop it. And the United States used to be the country that put the most pressure on those countries. Iran's a little special case, as we know. Doesn't tend to listen to what the U.S. says these days. But our engaging in torture has undermined the ability to put pressure on these countries.
Held up to the world as our export
because of this torture. I just don't know how it's going to be replaced. And I guess the question I would have for you is, as those of us who are citizens, is there anything that we can do besides writing our congressmen and senators? But to me, I don't think Americans quite understand the tremendous impact that this torture has had of lowering our reputation around the world.
I don't have to repeat that. I'll just repeat the question.
Reiterate questions, comments, I wouldn't worry about.
Okay. Well, there was a question about what we can do. First of all, don't underestimate the importance of writing your congressman. That on this and many other issues that aren't the top agenda issues for the country, when congressmen hear from a small number of constituents, say 10, 20, on the same subject, it makes a difference that they start seeing this as a groundswell. So I would not underestimate the importance of that. The second is public education. And I think that writing letters to editors and op-eds and blogs, all that kind of discussion is really important because people can understand, but they're bombarded with media that is very damaging, particularly this show, TV show. So we've got to figure out how to keep that message out there. Boy, there's so many people. I'll try to get everybody.
You were talking about a sort of moral reason not to torture, and also a utilitarian reason that it doesn't work. But I hear this discussion all the time with these two arguments in the same sentence, and it seems to diminish both arguments. Can you sort of divorce them from one and talk about the two, and maybe even talk about what happened in Germany with the policemen who threatened?
Actually, I don't know that case.
Well, as a moral question, it's an interesting dilemma. There was a kidnapper of a young child who was a diabetic in Germany, and he was caught and refused to stay where the child was. He was going to die if he didn't get his medication. So that in Germany, even the threat of torture is illegal. And he threatened torture, and the kidnapper told him where the child was, and the child was saved. And the policeman had to go to jail for threatening torture in that case. So that's a...
Actually, threatening torture is also illegal here. But you asked, this is a terrific question, the utilitarian and value question. That boils down to, what if torture worked? What if the techniques that I described that don't work and just cause horrific damage actually worked? It's a question we in the human rights community actually have a simple answer to, but don't want to talk about. The simple answer is value should trump everything. That is, if we really believe in human dignity, if we really believe that torture is wrong, that you should not do this to another living human being, then that's the end of it. And that's why, under all the international treaties, there are no circumstances whatsoever, including a national emergency, when torture is justified. On the other hand, so that is my answer, that even if torture worked, I think we'd have to be against it. There are also kind of reasons that link these. One of them is that it spreads, that you can't control it, so that's kind of an empirical issue. But I think we do have to come to grips with that question, and it's a hard one. But I don't think there is any other answer. We're fortunate in some ways that torture doesn't work. It reinforces the value, but we don't talk about it enough. Can we we'll go here and then this side of the room, okay? The question was, what have there been successful interrogations? The answer is, I'm sure there have been, but I'm not privy to them. Obviously, these are national security issues, and nothing about successful information gathering is shared with the public. Every so often, the president will cite some information, but I don't think we know. So I just can't answer that. Over here. Okay, the first question was, they say it works.
Why do they continue to do it?
I'm
not advocating this, I'm just saying that this is one of the things that they say, that it does work, and why do they continue to do it if it really doesn't?
Well, on the question of why they continue, in fact, the Defense Department is not doing most of these things anymore. So they have concluded that not only is it wrong, but it doesn't work, and so they have stopped. We are not privy to what information the CIA has gotten at these black sites, and that relates to your second point. The one really important thing is you cannot take at face values the assertions that we're getting good information, because I believe that the record of their credibility on that point is close to zero. On the question of the Military Commissions Act, the Military Commissions Act was a disaster. It was enacted just before the election last fall, and after a stance by three Republican senators, McCain, Graham, and Warner, against the White House, led to a stalemate. They compromised. The Democrats, meanwhile, went under the table to hide and didn't want to have anything to do with this, and were very happy for three Republican senators to be taking the lead. And when a terrible compromise came out, they allowed it to go through, really only fighting the abolition of habeas corpus for Guantanamo detainees, which the Supreme Court, by the way, just decided to decide. In that law, we have a new standard that says, well, information obtained by torture will be excluded from evidence, but information obtained from coercive interrogation may be allowed. This is a first in American history. The idea that you can have coerced confessions introduced into evidence against you is entirely new. So we have this problem. Whether these military commissions will ever happen, whether anybody will ever be successfully prosecuted because of all the other problems, is up for grabs. But we're going to find out. And the other thing is that there's one other thing that shows the true perversity of what's been going on. The government takes the position that the interrogation techniques used in a case, even a case where someone is being brought to trial, are matters of national security, that we cannot reveal what we're doing to people. So the defense that I was tortured can't really be used because we can't reveal what was done. So on top of this use of coerced confession, they are taking the position that we can't even have the lawyers for the detainee know what was happening to the person. So we're in a bad situation, and you've been waiting very long.
Of not taking a position that suits some of the members against this totally. And I was wondering what you think that professional organizations involved in this, such as the American Psychological, the American Medical, the American Psychiatric, should do. Because not only is it damaging our values, but as you said, it's damaging the professional organizations.
That's a terrific question. I just didn't have time to go into this, except to allude to the corruption of these professions in this work. The question was about the role of the medical and psychological professions and what the association should do. These professions are conservative, not in politics, but in terms of getting involved in public issues that don't involve their own bread and butter issues. And notwithstanding that, the American Medical Association and the American Psychiatric Association took positions, actually at our behest, saying physicians and psychiatrists should have no role whatsoever in interrogations, except in a general sense of training people. But in an individual case, they should not be involved. And that means, that's the underlying principle, was there's nothing good that can come out of this participation, even if there's no torture, because what happens is that you become enmeshed in the machinery of interrogation. And if you have a, as you do, have an obligation to do no harm, participating is going to lead to harm, and you shouldn't do it. And in fact, the evidence is, even from Pentagon's own reports, is that psychologists and physicians were actually involved in advising interrogators when to push harder. They actually became the calibrators of the degree of pain. So they have taken the position, do not participate. The psychologists have a different attitude. And the reason is that for many years, psychologists have been engaged in research, they've been engaged in intelligence collection activities, and there are many of them who believe they should be involved. And in fact, the association appointed a task force on this issue, the majority of whom were actually involved in intelligence activities. Not surprisingly, they said it's really okay to participate in intelligence activities. And my organization has been very involved with dissident psychologists to try to change that. In fact, they're having a convention next month, where this will all come to a head. It seems to me that the psychologists should take the position that they should not participate in interrogation. And they, along with the other and the medical association, should condemn all the techniques that have been used that amount to torture, the psychological techniques, and that would be an advance as well.
So just to say that you believe that their position, that if the psychologist is there and when the interrogation is going on, they can actually help prevent the interrogation from getting out of hand, is something that you would not agree with?
Definitely, I do not agree with it. I think it has the perverse effect of legitimizing coercive interrogation. You can go on our website. I'm happy to give that information to you. We're running out of time, but I want to get everybody in. We'll go around the room.
I think part of the problem, or part of the reason it's still a problem, is that not a lot of alternatives are being suggested by people. So I was wondering what alternative humane methods do you think for now are effective?
The question is about what humane methods are effective. In fact, there are. I started by saying there are methods of interrogation which experienced interrogators use and do find effective. The basic theory of interrogation, and it's not surprising if you think about it, people try to develop relationships. And over time, people in prison, remember, they don't have a lot of other sources of support. You talk to them every day, you learn about their lives, you figure out what they're interested in, you fool them into becoming their friend, you start getting information. You figure out what's in their interest, what they care about. I am not an interrogator. I'm not an expert, but I've spent time with them. And they get information, and they're very confident about it. Not every time, but they're confident it can be done. Let's go on. Let's go around the room.
Torture is
That is, why do we do this? I think it's a $64 question. I think that it gets down to we're tough. We're going to be tough. And that's the cowboy attitude of this administration. And it's consistent with other things they've done. And it's as simple as that. The vice president has said that waterboarding is a no-brainer. Now, that is about the worst. People who have experienced it, mock drowning, it's absolutely terrifying. Mock execution is another one, where they hold a gun to your head and they said you're going to die. It's terrifying, and it can destroy your life. And it doesn't yield information or correct information, but it's a tough thing to do. Next. It's how can the U.S. regain its position in human rights? It's like, you know, you got to come clean. That's the first thing you got to do. You got to acknowledge that we've done terrible wrongs. You have to have a full investigation of everything that's happened in a transparent way. You have to hold people accountable up to the highest levels of government. And you have to establish new rules that are very public. And then the last thing is you have to abide by them in a very obvious way. So those are the five things. It could happen. I hope it does happen. We can make it happen. But that's what's required in my view.
You commented earlier on the effect on the torture. But there are layers and layers and layers of people all the way up to the top. And you talk about holding them accountable. With the psychiatrists and psychologists, there's a statement made by
Yeah, the most amazing aspect of this is how people can rationalize. Just to give you an example, there's a fellow named John Rizzo who was assistant general counsel and acting general counsel of the CIA. He was been around for the last 5 years. He was involved in all of this. He is now nominated to be general counsel of the CIA. My organization is opposing him for reasons I think you can understand. But he has figured out a way to internalize these rationalizations, that this is really legitimate. And I think we all do that. We all are capable of rationalizing terrible things. And I don't know what the ultimate effect is. I think the good news is many people have gone the other way. They've said, I can't abide this. I don't know if this is it. Good answer to your question.
In many ways, it is the answer because we, as animals, we are amazing at rationalization. In my law practice, I find that all the time. But the problem I see is the way in which perhaps the administration, and maybe I'm being too hard on this particular administration, seems to gloss over a number of things which have corrupted the way in which their definitional works apply to our society, including the way in which the Constitution is interpreted.
That's true. Next and last, I think.
Thank you.
That's a great way to end. Yeah, the question is whether these folks could be prosecuted. I will say this. You know, you want to end on hope? It took how many years? 30 years for Pinochet to be prosecuted. It may take a long time for people like Rumsfeld to be prosecuted. But my view is that under the law, he could be and should be. And someday, maybe, will be.
Just a technical question. Is rendition, if defined as an American, a prisoner of war taken by Americans and transferred to a different country, is that illegal in any way under American law? I know Europeans are being prosecuted at this time. Does American law provide a penalty for
the question is whether extraordinary rendition is illegal. Now, of course, it's not just a prisoner of war. These are just any people off the street that are transferred. I am not an expert in whether that is a crime, but I assume it is. Let me thank you. One final word. Those of you who are interested in this, you can go on our website, physiciansforhumanrights.org. You can get involved. We need to fight this, and we'd be delighted to have you. You're a great group, and I enjoyed this, and thank you. Janet!